like to deal with a, say, a new answer to a question that dealt with in the past. That's a very, very fascinating question. It's a question that we have 2,000 years already. Chazal tell us that Rabbi Akiva says, V'yohavta l'reacha kamocha ze klal gadol b'Torah. One should love his friend like himself. Rabbi Akiva says that is the fundamental principle of the Torah. His student Ben Azai asked him a question, what about if you don't like yourself? What about if you're mevuza beinecha? The Torah says, v'yohavta l'reacha kamocha. Love your friend like yourself. What about if a person has low self-esteem? Then if that, how could this be the fundamental mitzvah in the Torah? If in fact a person has low self-esteem, then he will not treat his friend like himself, and that will be inappropriate because the Torah doesn't require him to treat his friend better than himself, only like himself. So how can you say this is the basic principle of the Torah? What about if you don't like yourself? That was Ben Azai's question to Rabbi Akiva. So because of that question, it's a very sophisticated question. You can start thinking that 2,000 years ago, when Jews were dealing with these questions, other people were still savages eating people and swinging from trees. And our great-grandparents were dealing with this level of sophistication. So because of this, Ben Azai says that the basic principle of Torah is a different one. And he brings another pasuk, Zeh Sefer told us Adam. Another sentence. I'd like tonight to see if we can perhaps get a new insight in answering Ben Azai's question to Rabbi Akiva. How do you deal with your Yohavta L'Reacha Kamocha if in fact you have low self-image? Another question I'd like to deal with is, we have a very interesting Tosfos that we find. Tosfos says an interesting thing. He brings that the Talmud tells us a story regarding certain rabbis who did things that were beyond the letter of the law. For example, there was a person who is, it's not, who's below his dignity to do a certain kind of help, to render his friend a certain kind of help. What does it mean it's below his dignity? It means he wouldn't do it for himself. A person who's the kind of person that for him, even for himself, if it was, he would lose his own money, or if his ox was laden down and falling under his under the weight of his load, it would be beneath this person's dignity to do it, so that he's not obligated for somebody else. The Talmud tells us regarding a person that was in such a situation, he didn't do it for someone else, but what he did is he paid for the other person's load. And then not only that, when he paid for the load, after he paid for it, he said, it's hefker, it's whoever wants can take it. So the person who it was originally belonged to picked it up again, and then he reloaded his donkey, and again it's falling on the load, so he bought it a second time. And the Talmud says on this, he did lifnei mishuras hadin. He went beyond the letter of the law, and the Talmud brings a sentence to establish an obligation of that a Jew is obligated to go beyond the letter of the law. Then the Talmud tells us another story about another rabbi who found some animals that were lost in the desert. After 12 months, in which time for sure the owner had given up hope and everything else, and he returned the objects, the Talmud says he also went beyond the letter of the law. The difference between the two is, in the first case, when the Talmud cited the obligation to go beyond the letter of the law, the Talmud brought a sentence in the Torah to support that, that a person is obligated to go beyond the letter of the law, and brought a sentence as it's written. Pasuk says like this, V'adatu lehem, es haderech asher yelchu bo. And then it says asher yasun v'sa maisa asher yasun. So asher yasun is lifnim mishur sadin, to go beyond the letter of the law. It's an obligation to go beyond the letter of the law. And then not only that, the Talmud says that there's a... afterwards says another interesting statement that Jerusalem was only destroyed because Jews did the letter of the law. They didn't go beyond the letter of the law. So it's very incumbent on a person to go beyond the letter of the law. In the other case, the Talmud did not bring a sentence in the scriptures that a person is obligated to go beyond the letter of the law. They just said this rabbi did this because he went beyond the letter of the law. The Tosfos says, that's the commentator on the side of the Talmud, says the following difference. He says like this, that there are two kinds of going beyond the letter of the law. There's one kind of going beyond the letter of the law that I'm not obligated to do something. I'm a person who it's below my dignity to do this thing. And on that, for that, the Talmud brings a sentence that you are obligated to go beyond the letter of the law. The other case is where nobody is obligated to do this. In other words, for example, in the first case, let's say there'd be another person wasn't there, but had there been somebody else standing there that loads his own donkey and unloads his own donkey, then that's a person somebody else would be obligated to help his friend out. It's just that I was unusual, that I'm not the kind of person, I don't do it for myself, I don't have to do it for my friend. But X, Y, and Z who do it for themselves have to do it for their friends. And therefore, on this, the Talmud is, that's one kind of beyond the letter of the law. The other beyond the letter of the law is that nobody has to do it. No one has to do it, and still he went beyond the letter of the law. So that's what Tosfos says, that when do we bring a sentence to say that you have to go beyond the letter of the law? That's when other people are obligated to do it, and you're not obligated. So the sentence says that you are also, that there's it's the right thing to do, go beyond the letter of the law. So even though he says that when nobody's obligated, you're also obligated to go beyond the letter of the law, but for that we don't bring a sentence. Now, that's very difficult to understand. In other words, if you need a source in the Torah that there's an obligation to go beyond the letter of the law when other people are obligated and I have a loophole, and still you need an obligation, then for sure you should have to require a source in the Torah to tell me that I have to go beyond the letter of the law when nobody is obligated to do. If there's 50 people and 49 are obligated, and because of my peculiar or my stature, I'm not obligated. So the Torah says if you're still obligated, there's still a notion you should go beyond the letter of the law. Okay? That requires a sentence. Then how could it not require a sentence? We need a source to obligate you. And how could it not require a sentence in the Torah to obligate us? Well, nobody. The Torah says this nobody has to do. So how are you supposed to figure out on yourself you're obligated to go beyond the letter of the law? It's very perplexing. If anything, the logic would almost be the other way. That in the case where other people are obligated, there it's logical that I should go beyond the letter of the law. I shouldn't make myself different than other people. Where nobody is obligated on that, I would seem to think I might not need a sentence to tell me, nevertheless, you should go beyond the letter of the law. And Tosfos says exactly the reverse, that if nobody is obligated, that you don't require a sentence for. The Talmud doesn't bring a sentence. Whereas if everybody is obligated except for you, then the Talmud brings a sentence. It's very seemingly very illogical. In this week's parsha, I have a number of things I think that need some clarification. First of all, we have a guarantee that the Torah tells us that there's always going to be poor people. Lo yechdal evyon mikarev haaretz. There's always going to be poor people. The other sentence that the Talmud discusses a contradiction. One place it says there won't. So it says that there will always be poor people, but they won't necessarily be from your own. If the Jews, all the Jews, do exactly what they're supposed to, there will always be poor people, but not from yours. Why should there always be poor people? If everyone's doing what we're supposed to do, then why are we, you know, is the rest of the world is perfect? everyone does what you're supposed to. Nosati matar artzachem vito. The rains come at the right time. Things produce at the right time. There's the crops in abundance. Everything is wonderful. Why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu see fit? One thing is going to remain, poor people. There's always going to be that mishuluch knocking at the door. Why? Why? What's the reason for that? HaKadosh Baruch Hu is able, if he gives so many blessings, he can spread it around a little bit more. You know, let it be a little bit more, and then everybody else will have enough. What does this mean that it has to be poor people? It sounds like that there's always going to be some imperfection here. Why? What's the reason for that? Everything else works, but there's still a guarantee there will always be poor people. What's the notion? Also, it's very interesting. It doesn't say poor people. It says, Losechtal Evyon. Evyon, Rashi says, is worse than poor. Evyon is somebody who needs everything. There's poor, and then there's somebody who wants everything. There's nothing he's not wanting for. There's nothing that he's not lacking in. That's an Evyon. There will always be. That's difficult to understand. What is the need for that? We have another mitzvah that we learn out in this week's parsha. The pasuk says, "Acharei Hashem Elokeichem Teilechu." You have to follow in the footsteps of God. So, Chama Bar Chanin explains, the Gemara explains this the following way. Is it possible for a person to really follow next to God? You get consumed by God. God is, the Spirit of God is like a fire, consume a person. No, what it doesn't mean that you are physically in the proximity of God, but it means that you should follow in His path, in His character traits. Just like God clothes the naked, you should clothe naked people. Just like He visits the sick, you should do the same. Just like He comforts mourners, you should do the same. Just like He buries the dead, you should do the same. And the Talmud then brings citations to show us that God visited the sick by Abraham, He comforted the mourners, He buried Moshe Rabbeinu. We find all these different things, and therefore you should do them. The problem is that we already know that a Jew is obligated to do these mitzvahs. The Rambam tells us that in Hilchos Avot, in the laws of Avelis, all these particular mitzvahs are included under V'ahavta L'Reacha Kamocha, under the obligation to love your friend like yourself, includes all these things: burying the sick, visiting the burying the sick is not quite yet a mitzvah. Burying the dead, visiting the sick. That's all included. He says the rabbis have made it a particular thing, but he says certainly it's already included in the Ohavta L'Reacha Kamocha. It's already included under the penumbra of the mitzvah of love your friend like yourself. Why do we find in this week's parsha an additional mitzvah, an additional obligation based on, well, you don't need another pasuk. We already have the Ohavta L'Reacha Kamocha, which tells us we have to love our friend, and that certainly includes doing these things that you would want someone to do for you. Interesting, in this week's parsha, as we spoke between Mincha and Maariv, there's a mitzvah of Hanukkah, that when a servant finishes his 6 years of work, you have to give him a bonus. It's very interesting to note all the laws of servitude, how long he works, when he leaves, how he leaves, different forms of that they create a freedom for a servant, are all discussed in Parshas Mishpatim, in the book of Exodus. The one law that's introduced new over here is the law of Hanukkah. I was just wondering. I find that very troublesome. And first of all, that's a very disorganized thing to do. If you already have all the laws of Eved in one place, Kisikna Eved Ivri, when you buy a Jewish servant, the Torah lays out all the laws. What is the Torah here laying out this new mitzvah here of Hanukkah? What is that doing over here? Trying to understand that this mitzvah doesn't belong here. It should be together with all the other mitzvahs in the Torah regarding all the other details. It's just one of the sub-details in the laws of the Jewish servant, how you have to deal with your Jewish servant. Why has this been separated off from the body of the laws of Eved Ivri, which we find in Sefer Shmos? One last question. Maybe I ask two questions. Torah tells us Bonim atem la'Hashem Elokeichem. You are children to the Almighty. Lo sisgaidedu v'lo yisosimu korcha ben einechem l'meis. God forbid someone loses a relative. One is not allowed to make a cut in his skin as a sign of mourning. One is not allowed to rip out hair from his head as a sign of mourning. And Rashi says the reason for that is, what does this have to do with the beginning of the sentence, Bonim Atem LaShem? So Rashi says that you are bon. Let me get the exact language. Rashi says that you shouldn't make the cut on a dead person, because you are the sons of the Almighty, and therefore it is proper that you should look good, you should be noim, you should be pleasant looking. So Nachmanides asked the question on Rashi, if that's the reason, then what about, let's say, somebody didn't die? God forbid a person went bankrupt, and out of anguish he cuts his body. He hasn't violated anything. This is only a prohibition for the dead. If the reason is, according to Rashi, because we're the sons of the Almighty, and therefore we have to look good, then it should be prohibited to do it for any reason. Not only if somebody dies, if somebody goes bankrupt, it should be forbidden to do it also. That's Nachmani's question on Rashi. And one last question I want to ask, that in this week's parsha, we have another mitzvah. We have the mitzvah to build the Beis HaMikdash. There's a mitzvah on the Jewish people that's incumbent upon us to build a temple mount in Jerusalem, to build the temple. And the mitzvah is L'shichno Sidra Shul Vasa Shama, that you should build a temple. The Rambam brings this mitzvah in the laws of Kings. In the laws of Beis HaBechira, in the laws where he deals with the laws regarding the temple, he brings a different sentence. He brings a sentence from the book of Shmos. For Osuli Migdosh Vishochanti Besocho, and you should make for me a sanctuary, and I will dwell in its midst. So the Kesef Mishnah really asked the question, why does the Rambam need two sentences? The way we could ask the question is, why do we need two parshas in the Torah? Why do we need the parsha in the Torah in the book of Exodus, where it tells us that we are obligated to build a Migdosh, and another mitzvah here in the book of Deuteronomy to tell us a second time we are obligated to build the Migdosh? All right, the questions again, just to recapitulate. We're trying to understand, question number one, we're trying to understand what is the proper answer? How does Rabbi Akiva answer Ben Azai's question? Rabbi Akiva says the basic principle of the Torah is love your friend like yourself. What about if you don't like yourself? if you have low self-esteem, how could you have no starting point? That's Ben Azai's question on Rabbi Akiva. How does Rabbi Akiva answer that question? Secondly, we're trying to understand if there's an obligation that we know that you are obligated to go beyond the letter of the law. When nobody is obligated, why do we need a special sentence when other people are obligated and you are not obligated, that you should also go beyond the letter of the law? The reverse seems true. If nobody's obligated, I should go beyond the letter of the law. Certainly, if everybody else is obligated other than me, there would be more of a reason to think that I should go beyond the letter of the law. And we're trying to understand why did the Ribbono Shel Olam tell us that there is never, what is that, a punishment for us? That there's never, poor people are never going to go out of the land, no matter how good, no matter how perfect we are, there will always be poor people. What, more than poor, impecunious, impoverished people, destitute, I guess would be a good word, destitute people. There will always be destitute people. Why? What's the need for that? And we're trying to understand why we need an obligation to bury the dead, to visit the sick, to comfort the mourners. What do we need a mitzvah for in the Torah in this week's parsha when we already have that mitzvah included in the Ahavta L'Reacha Kamocha, love your friend like yourself? Rambam says that's included in that. Then we're trying to understand why is the prohibition only to cut your body, if it's because your body has to be beautiful, was what Rashi says. So why is the prohibition only in cutting your body over as an act of mourning, but cutting your body over some other tragedy the Torah did not prohibit? And lastly, we're trying to understand why we need two commandments to build a sanctuary. So there are two mitzvahs in the notion of kindness. In the mitzvah of doing kindness for other human beings, the Ahavta L'Reacha Kamocha, there are really two totally different aspects of that mitzvah. One aspect of the mitzvah of doing kindness for other human beings is that there is a need. People have needs, and I have to identify with the needs of other people. It's part of my being connected to other people. Hashem wants me to be connected, obviously, to other people. I don't mean it's not something Hashem didn't command me on. Hashem commanded me. I have to be connected to other people. I have to be sensitive to their needs. Kindness itself means like I see they are from my kind, and I identify with them. I find a kindred spirit with them, and therefore I am identifying with another human being's needs, and I am fulfilling a mitzvah that the Torah tells me I'm obligated to do. That's one mitzvah. That's one aspect. There's a total different aspect for the mitzvah of kindness. You have a very interesting thing. Avram Avinu, our father Abraham, is considered to be his most outstanding virtue. On one hand, we find his chesed, his kindness. The Torah tells us, titein chesed l'Avram. The Navi says that Avram is identified as chesed, as kindness. On the other hand, we go through the Torah, we know that Avram Avinu is the father of monotheism. Avram Avinu is Emuna. He is the one that brought, the Rambam tells us, that brought tens of thousands of people back to monotheism. He himself logically arrived at the conclusion that the world, there's a monotheistic God. There's only one God. That is something he arrived at. And he went around and announced his whole life proclaiming the oneness of God. On the other hand, we find kindness. Was this that Avram Avinu just had a number of different traits? Say no. They are really one and the same. in the following way. If we understand that there's one God who is omnipotent, embodies perfection, and this is not a God that needs a world. God is perfect. God does not need a world. The fact that God created the world tells me that God is interested in doing kindness. As soon as we define God as being one God and being all of reality, that at that moment, the fact that there's something exists other than God, who we know is all of reality, then we automatically recognize that this God's interest is to do good for others. We understand from the fact that the world exists is not for God's needs. God doesn't have any needs. We understand that creation itself means that God wishes to do good. Therefore, the definition of emunah and kindness is one and the same. The ultimate thing that we see by God is the fact that he was kind. That's the whole revelation of the world. The fact that the world exists, we know, is not for his sake. God is perfect. God doesn't need it. God is everything. The fact that a world exists means that God wished to do something for someone else. God wished to be native. And therefore, the definition of, when you talk about emunah, the certainty and knowledge of the reality of God being including all of reality, means that if there's something that exists, that can only be because God wanted to do kindness. Therefore, Avraham Avinu is the father of kindness, the father of chesed, and godliness. It's one and the same. Chesed is the ultimate expression of godliness. That's what we saw in the world. We saw in the world God, and if there's a God, and there's a world, that can only be because God is kind, because God doesn't need any world. God only wants to be mativ. Therefore, in the act of chesed, there's another dimension. The act of chesed is the way in which the act of kindness is the way in which the man achieves the highest form of identification with God. The greatest way you can become close to someone is through emulating them. Emulating them is my strongest feeling of identification. I want to do the things that they do. That's the closest way and most genuine way that a person can express his connection to something is by emulating it, imitating. I mean, all of Madison Avenue, all of marketing in the United States is built on that premise. Marketing things, you get some image Madison Avenue figures out some image that people want to identify, and that image drinks this kind of scotch and drives that kind of car and smokes that kind of cigarette and wears that kind of clothes. And since there's a subliminal desire for people to identify with who they consider their heroes, things they idolize, then therefore they will go out and buy those things because in their minds, when they are buying those things, they are seeing themselves as being connected to whatever model, whoever they are idolizing. That's the notion of the mitzvah in the Torah of a halachta bedrachav. The mitzvah in the Torah, uboi sidbach, that we have to cleave to God. The way we cleave to God, the ultimate attachment to someone is not holding on to them. The ultimate attachment to someone is emulating their ways, identifying in the way they act. That is the closest form of connection anybody can have to someone else, is the fact that the way he becomes the dveikus, the connection, is not by being next. That's what it says. By that you'll get consumed. You stand next in the proximity of God, you'll be consumed by fire. The notion is that you want to emulate him. The imitea dia is the highest form of connection. That's the mitzvah of Bo'i Sidbach. And therefore, every time we do kindness, we are really doing two things. Or there's two dimensions to kindness. There's one dimension of kindness, which is identifying a kindred spirit with my friend. That's what the word kindness means. He's one of my kind. There's a kindness. I sense my similarity to him, and therefore I want to there's a natural inclination in a person to feel closer and to identify with something that he senses a kindred spirit with. He senses your way and you're traveling and you see somebody else from Miami that who knows, I mean, if you ever see them here, you walk across the street, you know, to avoid seeing them. But over there, 5,000 miles, oh, how you doing? You know, you sense something, you have something in common as a sense of identification, identifying with a person. The more you have in common, the more you sense that you are one of a kind, the closer feeling of wanting to do things. That's what the word kindness means. I am acting like we are one of a kind. I sense our similarity, and therefore I am doing things for him. That's one aspect of the mitzvah of chesed, and that we learn after in V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. There's another mitzvah of chesed, and that we learn out from this week's parsha. That we have to cleave, follow in the ways of God and cleave to him. That mitzvah is the mitzvah of doing things because in doing acts of kindness, besides that I am sensing a kindred spirit with my friend, I am sensing a kindred spirit with the Almighty. Because the Ribbono Shel Olam himself, God himself does kindness. God himself was involved in kindness. And therefore it's not my connection only to my friend. When I do an act of kindness in my mind, I am imitating and emulating the Almighty, and therefore I am thereby connecting myself to him simultaneously. See, that's the two mitzvahs, to answer the Rambam. One mitzvah is included under V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. That mitzvah means identify with your friend. And that's obviously not a difficult thing, because human beings, there's a natural tendency to identify with things that are more similar to you. A second aspect is the mitzvah in this week's parsha, which is don't only do it because you identify with him, but recognize that when you do kindness, you are elevating yourself and identifying with God himself. And that's what it means to follow in God's footsteps. So even though, let's say, according to many Rishonim, the Yerushalmi brings the pasuk, there's even a mitzvah in the Torah to bury the dead. Forget about Ahavta Re'echa Kamocha. There's Rishonim who say that one of the 613 mitzvahs is Ki Kover Tikvarenu, that there's an obligation to bury the dead. 100% there's an obligation to bury the dead. And yet there's another mitzvah in this week's parsha, bury the dead because God buries the dead. Difference is, there's the mitzvah to bury the dead, that's what I owe to my friend, to my dead friend. The mitzvah in this week's parsha is is my way of identifying with God himself. Okay, now so that's to answer the Rambam and to explain why we need a new mitzvah in this week's parsha. We take this a step further, comes another very, very fascinating thing. What does it mean that the Torah obligates me to emulate God? What do you mean I have to imitate God? I mean, it's like the phoniest thing, imitate somebody. You know, people have all kind of illusions, delusions of who they are, and they start imitating people. I mean, it becomes very funny even. And start imitating God. I mean, who do you think you are? Meshuggah? Are you crazy? You know what I mean? Start imitating God. They start, you know, someone starts picking up the gestures of some sport figure. You look at him. Oh. Where do you come to him? He runs he runs the 109 seconds. Who are you imitating? Who are you emulating? You have no connection to him. I mean, it looks very phony. It must be, if the Torah told us that we are obligated to emulate God, that means all of us have within ourselves a potential to express godliness. Bonim atem lasha. What the sentence that means you are God's children, whatever that means, and I won't get into, obviously there's a lot of philosophical questions, what does it mean a child of God? But one thing it surely means is that you have within yourself that potential to be like him. That's the least it means is that God made us his children means that we have within ourselves a potential to be like him. Because when you talk about a child has the DNA of the father, of the parents, and therefore the child has within himself the genes of the parents, which means he has within himself the potential of the parents. The least it means, and however it means, avada, doesn't mean God put his self into us, but at least it means he put the potential within ourselves, in our soul, to be able to express the things he does. Otherwise, it would be a very ludicrous thing to think that God says, imitate me. Imitate me would be like a child, like, you know what it would look like? Maybe the best example would be the 3-year-old, a girl who starts putting on her mother's shoes and a dress and a wig and a jewelry. I mean, it takes a big pocketbook. It just is totally out of place. It doesn't fit her. Or the son who steps into his father's size 10, the 3-year-old boy who steps into his father's size 10 shoes and his size 7 1/4 hat that comes over his this, and he puts his father's belt on, it goes around 3 times. It just doesn't, it's totally not fitting here. It must be, if the Torah says that we do it, it means that it does fit. It fits us. It expresses our inside soul, because this is what our potential is. Bonim atem l'Hashem means that's the minimum potential we have. That's what the Torah is telling us by that pasuk of Bonim atem l'Hashem. If so, then we have another really incredible insight. When a person begins expressing those things and doing those things, the Gemara tells us that the pasuk says, "Ze keli v'anvehu." This is my God v'anvehu. One opinion is v'anvehu, and I will beautify him. Another opinion is v'anvehu is an acronym. It's a combination of two words, ani v'hu. This is my God, I and he. What does it mean, I and he? So the Talmud says, Abishol Oimer. It means if you're just like God is compassionate, just like God is kind, you should do the same. Ani v'hu. But you should be Zekeli v'anvehu, and you act like him, you be like him. What it means is that if this is what my potential is, that when I start expressing this potential, I will get in touch with the godliness within myself also. If a person wants to feel the godliness within himself, then what does the person have to do? The person has to begin expressing that godliness. The way you get in touch with the godliness, there's a mitzvah to identify and emulate him, that tells me at some level that it's not something that doesn't suit you. It must be something that suits you and is expressive of who you are. If it's something that suits you and it's expressive of who you are, then as you begin doing it, it really expresses who you are. You really know now who you are, and you really sense your sense of godliness also. It becomes ani v'hu, you and he. I and he. That is the answer to Rabbi Akiva's question, to Ben Azai's question. The question was, the Torah says, Rabbi Akiva said, V'yohavta l'reacha kamocha. Ben Azai says, what about if you don't like yourself? What about if you don't like yourself? He brings a different source to answer that. The way Rabbi Akiva answers that is, you express kindness to your friend, you sense the God, but you act the way God does, you do the acts of kindness to your friend, then you become in touch with the kindness within yourself, that itself ennobled, and you feel ennobled, you feel uplifted, you feel that it gives you a sense of godliness, that itself will solve your problem. What's your problem? You feel low? There's one way you can get in touch with the godliness within yourself. The Torah tells us, that's what Zeklal Gadol B'Torah means. Do this answers the problem of self-esteem. low self-esteem because I feel like I'm nothing. I'm insignificant. I'm another ant on a log that just doesn't make a difference. I'm not steering anything. I'm not doing anything. My whole life doesn't have any purpose and meaning. If a person begins to do acts of kindness, since that is the thing in which we are similar to the Almighty, we will feel our connection to godliness. We'll feel our sense of immortality. We'll feel our elevated soul. We'll feel our identification with Him. And therefore, a person will feel uplifted. A person will feel bonim atem l'Hashem. You know, it's one thing a person comes into a university and he's freshman over there, and maybe he's on some kind of economic hardship scholarship for minorities, and he's maybe they had a little lower entrance standards for him, and he walks in there and feels awed and overawed and humiliated by all the splendor and intelligence and power around him. Or if he walks in there, he only happens to be the president, is the president's son. You know, then he walks into the school with a different feeling. His feeling in the world is different. He feels he belongs. He senses his entitlement. He senses his feeling of aristocracy. The greatest way in which we can feel our godliness is do the acts of kindness. They bring out the godliness. That is the way we identify them, because that means latently we have that potential in ourselves. And through doing the acts of chesed, we are ennobled and we feel bonim atem l'Hashem. And there can't be anything for a person's self-esteem more than really feeling a connection to the Almighty Himself. If I really feel that I am connected to God, I feel, gives a person a feeling of immortality, gives a feeling of a person of being connected to the source of everything. That's not a person who has any problems with low self-image or low self-esteem. The answer to Ben Azai's question is, what Rabbi Akiva is saying is, the solution is Ohav Torecha. Do the act. Do the act. If you do the act and you do that, and you will sense within yourself a uplifted spirit, because you will be getting in touch with that part of you that has a sense of eternality in you. Because that's really what the mitzvah is. The mitzvah is to do those things that God does. And when you do those things that God does, you feel within yourself the godliness within yourself. You feel the potential within yourself. And that itself will give you a feeling of fulfillment and a feeling of a healthy sense of self. In fact, Rashi in Shabbos is a very interesting thing. Rashi says, "V'yohafta l'reacha kamocha." You see from Rashi that he really, in his first interpretation, learns that that does not refer to God, a friend. "V'yohafta l'reacha" doesn't mean love your friend like yourself. It means "v'yohafta l'reacha" means your friend and your father's friend, referring to God. So really, in that sentence, that's why Rashi translates the word reacha. Reacha, he brings a sentence that the Shlomo HaMelech says, reacha v'reach avicha, and that refers to God. The hafta l'reacha really means love God. What he's saying is, in the same sentence where it says the injunction to love your friend, is also thereby, that's an act of identifying and loving God too. In other words, if you put the two mitzvahs together, the mitzvah of loving your friend together with the mitzvah of follow in the path of God in this week's parsha, and we say ultimately both of those are really can be learned into the words of Ohav L'Recha Kamocha. You can learn that I have to love my friend and also love God, because that is my way in which I identify with Him by doing the things that He does. So every time I do something for my friend, if I am really sensitive to the fact that God acts this way, then I understand that I am emulating and identifying with God simultaneously. This explains something that I have to know has been very troubling. According to most of the Rishonim, we're going to be learning it this semester in the yeshiva, Goyim are not obligated in the mitzvah of tzedakah. That's not one of the seven Noahide laws. The city of Sodom is destroyed. Why? The Torah tells us. Because Yad Oni Ve'ev Yom Lo Hechziku. The prophet says the reason Sodom was destroyed was because they didn't do charity. That's what the prophet says. I guess we could learn other things and maybe try and explain that way. But the prophet says the reason Sodom was destroyed because Yad Oni Ve'Evyon Lo Hirziko, because they did not support the poor. They're going. It's the seven Noahide laws. That's before Sinai. Why does come that cataclysmic event of their destruction when in fact they're not obligated in that? The Ran in Sanhedrin proves from over here, from the fact that Sodom was destroyed, it must be that the Goyim are included in the mitzvah of charity. Otherwise, that's his proof. But the Rambam doesn't bring it. Most of the other Rishonim don't bring it. So why was the city of Sodom? What are we going to do with the Ran's question? How could the city of Sodom be destroyed? They're not obligated in charity. The mitzvah of tzedakah, they're not obligated. But one thing is, kindness is the definition of godliness. In a place which is anti-kindness means there is no godliness. That's what it means. The whole sense of creation in the world, as we said before, is kindness. That's the definition of God, kind. The existence of the world is kindness. If you are anti-kindness, if you reject the notion of kindness, then what you are really doing is saying there is no godliness in your world. You're living in a world without God. A world without God self-destructs. Sodom was destroyed because that was an area, that was a Medina, a country in which God did not have a presence. If there is no presence of God in the place, then that place will be destroyed. Not because they violated the seven Noahide laws. It was destroyed because there's no God. It doesn't have the stamp of God's universe. Every place, in order to exist, has to reflect God's presence. Sodom no longer reflected the presence of God. When you pull out kindness, when there is no kindness in a place, and there's no God, then that's not God's place. If that place isn't God's, a country in which there's no kindness is a country that's going to be destroyed. Just like the Rambam tells us that Sodom was destroyed because it was had more than half sins. The way I understand that means is there's no godliness. A place where there's sans godliness is sans existence. Because the definition of the world to exist is that it needs to reflect the handiwork of God. If there's no kindness, there's no godliness. And therefore, it's not a punishment. The world just self-destructs. With this, we now understand what we asked. Why is it, in fact, that there seems a punishment? There's always going to be poor people. Wrong. Poor people are not for the sake of their sake. Poor people is for our sake. The greatest favor that God can do us is to keep around the ability to give, to do kindness. If God would, God forbid, ever create a situation where there would be no need for kindness, then we would cease to be kind and giving human beings, then there would be no godliness in the world. The definition is the greatest favor for us is the opportunity to be kind. And, you know, I know this without this sentence. It's a very interesting statistic. You see it in New York City, the statistic even stronger than here. Here it's about 80%. But New York City, close to 90% of the money collected by the Federation in New York City is given by, 88% of the money is given by 2% of the givers. Of the givers, not of the population, which I don't know what that means. It's probably 1/10 or 1/20 of 1%. But it's 2% of the people give 90% of the money in the Federation, which is all the social aid, Jewish social agencies in New York, plus what they give to Eretz Yisrael, by 2% of the people. Yeah. Couldn't God, in his infinite wisdom, if 2% can give 90%, then maybe 3% could give 100%. They don't need a campaign anymore. You don't need dinners. You don't need missions. You don't need solicitations. You could all be friends again. You wouldn't be afraid to see people. You could be nice to everybody, and you wouldn't be afraid they're going to ask you for something. I mean, God could do that. It would be no problem at all. If 2% give 88, so 3% could easily give 100%. Over here, by the way, it's about 80% is given by about 2 or 3%. 70% is given, I think, here by 2%, which is also 5% of the givers. We're not talking about 5%. So I say, I think the answer to that is yes, there would be plenty of money for all the social agencies. Everything would want to be wonderful. There would be no, the wise wouldn't need money, the homeless wouldn't need money, the old people wouldn't need, the old age homes, everything would be wonderful. It would have as much as it has now. I mean, it would be just the, but there'd be one problem. There would be no longer Jews left, because there would be no longer Baalei Chesed. The greatest chesed, the greatest thing that God does for us is keeps alive in us the need, the opportunities to do chesed. That's what that maintains us. That gives us our connection to God. That is our godliness. That's what brings out our godliness. The purpose of chesed is not, it's obviously our friend needs it. That's the small value of chesed. For that, Hashem could have hundreds of other ways to make sure the poor wouldn't need. Hundreds of other ways to make sure that he wouldn't need, that he wouldn't be poor. There's no problem. There's absolutely no problem. The problem is, if there would be no chesed, then there would be no reason for our continuation. Because a door without being trained in chesed, a door that is not sensitive to doing kindness, is a door that a generation that's totally severed themselves from godliness. That's the haftocha of lo yechtal ani mikarev, lo yechtal evyon mikarev arts. God is telling us that there will always be opportunities for chesed, not only minorly chesed, evyon, to be able to give to the extent that another human being feels his whole existence comes from you, that he is so devoid of anything. He's an evyon. You're not only giving him money. An ani you're giving money to. An evyon you're giving him himself back to, because he feels totally hungry, needing of everything. It's not just that he's short money. He needs everything. There, the amount that you can do is the greater what you do for someone else, the more he receives, not in terms of money, but the more good you give him, the greater sense of identifying what godliness it is there. Because the whole notion of Kadosh Baruch Hu's chesed is that gives us all of reality. He gives us our reality. So the more you give reality to another human being, the more you become in touch with your godliness. That's the haftocha of Yechdal Evyon Mikarev Haaretz. So this, I think now we can understand the notion of the two inyanim of the Beis HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash really has two mitzvahs. There's one point in the Beis HaMikdash is to create, to build a place to go three times a year, Rambam says, a place to do, bring the sacrifices. The other notion of Beis HaMikdash is to be close to God, to be in his presence, to have his presence here. L'shichnoi sidrashu uvasashom, you should search out to give him here, make him your neighbor. L'shichno, to move him into your neighborhood, to give him a presence here. Because the ultimate feeling of God is we want to be feeling that closeness, feeling that sense of connection, because when we are in his presence, we then have the desire and the ability and the and we get more in touch with the feeling of emulating his ways. So there's really two mitzvahs in the mitzvah of building the Beis HaMikdash. There's one, to take care of our needs, to do sacrifices, to go up. We have to show him the proper homage three times a year, to go to Jerusalem. But in addition to that, it's l'shichno sidrashu, to sense his presence more, to awaken in us a greater sense of wanting to identify and wanting to be like him. This is really the difference between Sefer Shemos and Sefer Devarim. In Sefer Shemos, we have just begun emerging as a nation, and as emerging as a nation, to be a viable entity, there has to be a place, a capital building, there has to be a place where you have a center of government, a center of worship, which is obviously by us the same thing. That's where our king resides. It's his palace. So we, of course, there's a mitzvah to have his palace so that we can do what we have to do so that the country can survive. The Sefer Devarim, there we're discussing a whole different level. There we're discussing the Jew in Eretz Yisrael, our relationship to God in the land of Israel. Over there we are talking about identifying with God, the mitzvah we have over here, not merely Ahavta L'Recha Kamocha that we had before, but Acharei, to identify, emulate, bring out the godliness in us. That's a whole different level of existence. That's why over here there's a mitzvah Hanukkah. We said all the laws of social justice regarding slaves is in the book of Exodus. Okay, that is the slave's rights. The slave is not, you can't be indentured more than 6 years. If this and this happens, he has to be freed. If the young woman matures, she has to go out. You have many, many laws. And you have to try and marry her, etc. How you have to deal with her. All those laws are there. Those are slaves' rights. Hanukkah, the notion of giving a present, that's not slaves' rights. That's emulating God. The slave got paid entirely. He's already gotten his whole wages. Not only did he get his whole wages, he got his whole wages up front. So why have to give a man a bonus? He had the flow to the money for 6 years. I paid him up front his whole worth. So what do I have to give him a bonus for? You know, if you think you pay somebody at the end and he's really earned the money as you go along, all right, maybe you feel you added a little, you own a little more. But here you've done the greatest thing. You paid the man before he started working for you. You paid him 6 years, his whole salary up front. What do you give him a bonus? That's what the Torah tells us. The Torah says has nothing to do with the slave. Why? Because see what God did to us. When we left Egypt, he saw that we got paid a bonus. He saw that we got two bonuses. And therefore, you have to do the same thing. This is not a slave's rights. Slave's rights, that's the Parshas Mishpatim, which really the word Mishpatim itself means. Mishpat means what the slave is coming to the slave. Here we're not talking about slave's rights in Hanukkah. We are talking about emulating God. That's what that's exactly what the Pasuk says. I'm not adding a word. The Pasuk says that you should give him, because v'zochartu ki eved ha'yisa b'eretz Mitzrayim v'yiftecha Hashem Elokecha, that God redeemed you, and when he redeemed you, he gave you a present, a bonus. Therefore, you should do the same thing. That's emulating God. Here in Sefer Devarim, we are talking about the whole different aspect, that of emulating God, not giving my fellow man what's coming to him. What's coming to him, that the Torah sets up in Sefer Shemos and Vayikra in a little different dimension, a little higher level of what's coming to him, but they're his rights. Here we're not talking about his rights, we're talking about that act of chesed that ennobles me, that act of chesed that makes me into closer to God, that act of chesed that brings out my godliness, because the acts that I am doing because I saw that the Almighty himself does. This is the two dinim of Lifnei Meshuras Hadin. The two notions of going beyond the letter of the law. We said Tosfos says, in one place it says a sentence tells you have to go beyond the letter of the law. The other place it's not a sentence and you're obligated to go beyond the letter of the law. So yes, first of all, the logic's the opposite. There should be where you need a sentence should be where nobody is obligated, and where everybody but me is obligated shouldn't need a sentence. The sentence that tells us we have to go beyond the letter of the law is in Parshas Yisro, in the book of Exodus. That's also a sentence that, you know who said that? Yisro said that. Yisro told that to Moshe Rabbeinu. The father-in-law of Moshe Rabbeinu told him this. This convert told, according to some, maybe even before the Torah was given, if not, there was... Anyway, this is Yisro's message to the Jewish people. He is talking about the rights of another human being. There is a certain right in society that sometimes I can expect from another person, he'll go the extra step for me. Everybody else here, if there was anybody else here, they would help me unload my animal. Anybody else. Unfortunately, not unfortunately, but the only person here is you. So on that, Yisro said, you know what? Another human being is entitled to the fact that you should help him unload too. That's his right. That's his right. Not his right that he can take you to court for. It's beyond the letter of the law. But sometimes beyond the letter of the law is also a right. It's, I guess what they would call it, menschlichkeit. mentioned that, even though a great rabbi told me recently that whenever anyone does something menschlich, he's really shocked. But most of the people feel that menschlichkeit is something that we expect. The person to be a mensch, you expect them. It's just it's common decency. What he's saying here is that it's common decency. And therefore, the Torah obligates it. Well, not the Torah. What it means, the Torah obligates, it means the Torah, by writing the sentence, tells me that's the right of me, that I can expect from you, or I should expect from you, what? A little lifnei mishur something. I sometimes expect you got a little compassion, a little something in your soul for me. I feel that there's a certain level that a person almost feels it's coming to. Say, when is that? So that Tosfos says, when anybody else would have to do it. So the fact that you don't have to do it, you know what? It would be okay if you did it too. It would be the right thing. I can almost have some expectation, interest in your doing it. That's what the sentence tells me. The other thing is also an obligation, but it's not in that sense. That's part of following in the way of God. God, everything he does is lifnei mishuras hadin, because he owes nothing to anybody. Everything God does is ultimately just his kindness. He receives nothing from it. He needs it not at all. He only created the whole system in order to do kindness for us, because he's perfect. True, he set up a system where we do for him, but he only set up that system as a way of allowing us to feel comfortable in receiving from him. His whole idea here was to do kindness. Therefore, the obligation on me as a human being to go beyond the letter of the law, even when nobody is obligated to do it, because that's the obligation. Ultimately, a person should emulate the Almighty himself. Whereas the sentence tells me, our question was, if that you're obligated, so what do you need a sentence to tell you when other people are around? The sentence tells me that here the other person can have a claim to it, which means the difference is that, let's say, when nobody is around and I don't do it, I haven't reached the highest standard that I could. But my fellow man should say, you know, Rabbi, you're not a nice person, right? You know, I feel that you weren't kind to me. I feel that you didn't act nice to me. He has some kind of tightness, some kind of complaint, some kind of ill will towards me that he's not entitled to have, where nobody else is obligated. That is me as an individual. I should want to do that because I want to emulate God. Whereas in those situations where there's other people around who are obligated, if they would be around, they're obligated, and I am here and I'm not obligated, and there the Torah says I have to do it, I say what the Torah is saying is it's coming to him. And therefore, if I don't do it, he has a right to feel a little bit sore at me, a little bit upset with me, and be out of sorts with me, because that is his right. Here we're not talking about another human being's right. We're talking about purely my sense of elevating myself towards God. Right? Our question was, if there's a sentence that tells me, if I need a sentence to tell me that if everybody else has to return the lost object, except since I'm a person who doesn't do for myself, I don't have to do it, I'm not obligated to do it for you, but beyond the letter of the law, I should do it. And that's a sentence in the Torah that I need a pasuk to tell me that. The scriptures have to obligate me. So then how could it possibly be that without anything in the scriptures where the Torah says I'm not obligated at all, I have to do it? The answer is simple. Where the Torah says I'm not obligated at all, I have to do it because I have to identify with God. That sentence doesn't tell me, therefore, where you have a sentence, not to tell me I have to do it. The sentence tells me it's his right to expect it. He has an expectation interest over there where others have to do, and I by some reason, a quirk of the law, I'm not responsible to do. Over there, if I don't do it, I have violated his expectation right. He has some kind of right. And that's why we need the sentence. Sefer Shmos is mishpatim, is other people's rights. Sometimes it's a right of another human being to expect me to go beyond the letter of the law. It is never the right of another human being to expect me to do something that nobody else has to do. That between myself and the Almighty. It's incumbent upon me to do it, but it's not your right to expect it. You don't have a right, you don't have a claim on me to do it. It's my obligation to myself and to my connection to God and to uplift myself and to identify with God to do it, but you don't have a claim on me. Whereas in the other kind of beyond the letter of the law, you have a claim to expect it. Now we have to just think for a moment. The Talmud says Jerusalem was destroyed because they didn't go beyond the letter of the law. They only did the law and not beyond the letter of the law. Does that mean Jerusalem was destroyed for those things where my friends didn't have a claim on me, or my friend has a claim on me to go beyond the letter of the law and I didn't? God destroyed Jerusalem. Or Jerusalem, because of the special nature of Jerusalem, where there's a special presence of God hovering over since the moment of Akedas Yitzchak, from the moment that Isaac was bound on the altar. The Torah says, "Bayomahu hayom yeomer b'har Hashem yeirah." From that day on, it was said that the presence of God hovers over the mountain. Maybe over there, it means that that level of Jerusalem was destroyed because we did not have the additional thing of wanting to identify with God, even in those things that nobody is obligated. So that's not 100% clear for which one Jerusalem was destroyed. I think two ways to read it. You could say it's destroyed because since letter of the law is something the sentence tells me you have to do the letter of the law, therefore my friend has a claim. That's also becomes almost like the law itself, and therefore he's been hurt. And since he's been hurt, God destroyed Jerusalem. The Talmud brings it after that statement in the Gemara. But it's not necessarily directly connected, and therefore maybe it could even be under the other level, that Jerusalem was destroyed because in Jerusalem itself, there you need presence of God. And if we do not emulate God, imitate God in Jerusalem, then there will no longer that cause the destruction of Jerusalem. So this in conclusion, maybe we could all understand the Bonim Atem Lashem, the whole idea that we really have. We are his children. Very interesting. We are his children. We said that's really what brings to the fore the whole notion that we have within ourselves the potential of this godliness. It's possible to understand that really that our bodies give us that. That really what gives us this child, as much as he is the father, is also a separate identity from the father. And it's likely to be that the body is really what gives us our separateness from God. As much as it gives us, it reflects God, because it totally reflects our soul, but the fact that it has a corporeal existence and a corporeal being assures us of our separation, of our individuality. Because if in fact that we would have an incorporeal existence, then it could very well be that we would not really be ultimately, since we have the same potential and the same ability on a lesser level than the Almighty, we would eventually just be absorbed by that. And it could very well be that it is our bodies that give us that separate existence. That is what we have to maintain, the beauty of our bodies, the majesty of our bodies, because in that, in the body, is what really gives us our godliness is in our soul, but our body is what gives us our separate identity that embodies and reflects this incredible energy of our similarity to God. In fact, if you think about it, there's a Rashi in next week's parsha, in 2 weeks, incredible Rashi. Torah tells us that a person that curses God is hung. Means he's propped up against a piece of pole, and you have to bury him before nightfall because it's a curse to God. And Rashi says, what does it mean it's a curse to God, burying the person? Rashi says the following example, that a king had a twin brother, you know, Tom Canty, and a king had a twin brother, and one brother was executed as a criminal. So everybody will say they killed the king. meaning that a human being is so much like the image of God that when you kill a human being, it's almost God forbid that you're doing an act against God, and therefore you have to bury him quickly. You can't let him linger over there. That notion, I think, is expresses to us how visible it is in the human being's body. If you could read a person's body, if you could read a person's face, you can see all his qualities within him. That means you can see kindness, all the qualities that we see by the Almighty himself, that we know intellectually by the Almighty. We can really read on a person's face, because his body is really reflective of his soul. His body is the physical manifestation of the soul, and therefore you can see the kindness, you see all the godliness in him. And therefore we have to keep this thing noble, beautiful, because this thing is really, there's a godliness in here. And therefore, if a person kills, a person injures his body because of death, then what a person is really saying is he's saying, just like someone has died, so I'm going to hurt my or injure my body as a form of empathizing with the body, meaning that just like this body has died, Mali Kotla Kula, Mali Kotla Palga, I'll begin to bring some death into my own body by injuring it. That's the beginning of bringing some death into my own body. That's incorrect, because you can't identify with death. Our body, insofar as it reflects our soul, is an eternal entity. And therefore, because we are bonim atem l'Hashem, we are God's children. God's children means we have his soul, his potential. And how is that quantified and reflected? That's through our bodies. Since it's reflected through our bodies, therefore we can't identify with death. Well, we have to, our bodies always have to be an expression and a living expression of life itself, of eternality. And therefore when you put a sign in your body that to identify with death, it's not because it makes your body ugly. It's that you put in your sign in your body as an identification with death, so you're putting death in your body. That's a contradiction in terms to Bonim Atem L'Hashem. Bonim Atem L'Hashem means that we have a connection to God's eternality also. And therefore, we have to, therefore it's a cardinal principle of Judaism, the resurrection of the dead. The body is going to come back. It has to come back, because there has to be an eternality. Bonim Atem L'Hashem means our souls have all their godliness within, has all the potential. God obligated us to imitate him. That means we have within ourselves an enormous potential of godliness. This enormous potential of godliness is preserved and not ultimately just swallowed up by the body which reflects it. Therefore, in our body, we only have to have signs that reflect life, signs that preserve life, signs that are messages of life. To put in our body, God forbid, signs of death is to pervert the whole notion of what a body is. A body is really our connection to eternity. The body is our symbol of eternity, because in the person's body, you can see his soul. If you read a person right, you see kindness on his face. And when you see kindness on a person's face, you're seeing godliness on his face. Our bodies are our symbol of our identifying, the way we identify with God. That's our evidence of our godliness, and therefore there cannot be any signs of death in our body. Says Ramban asks on Rashi, why can't Hayilata defame you to cut your body for something else? It doesn't mean that. It means that it's not the problem because you're making your body ugly. If the problem is that you can't put anything that reflects death, you can't put a sign of death, because a sign of death is a contradiction in terms of what a body is. A body is to us the greatest symbol of life, because a body, in the body, we are able to see all the traits of the soul. The more a person can read a body, you can read a soul. And if you read the soul, you are seeing godliness, and that's the message of life. Good Shabbos.